resistance. Songbird, insurrectionary, versed in asymmetry. Into her neighborhood there glides a hawk to hunt, to take, to devour, digest. There it is, that mass fast approaching over the ridge. Do you see it? Well, it's been seen, and that's all that matters. A whistle carries faster than a shout, and clearer too. There it is, her soprano pitch, the first alert. Did you hear it? Well, it was heard, and that's all that matters. All around us now rises the choir. They're collecting themselves into an ocean wave. They're going off as a riot. Do you know what people call a group of smaller animals that mobilize like this against a predator? There's always someone ready to declare them a mob. The mob has surrounded the hawk now. Surely it's been only moments since his arrival? They're barring his path. They're screeching in his face. They're plucking his feathers. They must even be disturbing the flow of the currents his flight depends on. Yes, see, he's straying off target, great wings lilting awkwardly down and to the right. He screams, hollers, thrashes, threatens. He lashes out and sometimes, oh, yes, sometimes, he snaps a songbird's neck in the guillotine of his beak. But often, yes, and more often still, feasts only on empty air. Songbird, insurrectionary, versed in asymmetry. She and her neighbors know that only harried hawks go hungry. As repression has escalated, so too has resistance. Operation Metro Surge, which deployed approximately 3,000 federal agents to Minnesota, was extreme, violent, devastating, and also wildly inefficient. For all of that ground force, which could only be mustered by begging volunteers from other enforcement agencies, they were only able to make approximately one arrest per agent in 3 months of intensive occupation. This is because their incursions have been met with ferocious resistance, masses of people determined to hamper every minor movement of the regime, to toss a wrench into every gear. Operations that previously required only a few agents are now requiring a dozen or more. Even a platoon of ICE agents cannot guarantee success in places where resistance to them is widespread and passionate. And federal agents remain dependent on the isolation of their targets and the element of surprise in order to carry out their operations. When they are confronted directly, immediately, and loudly, they are often forced into a hasty retreat, their body armor and munitions made meek and ridiculous, costumes of war absurdly ill-suited to the battle at hand. And costly besides. Counter-surveillance of agents and direct obstruction of their operations, popularly known as ICE Watch, are among the more visible tactics of resistance to border enforcement. There are large and decentralized networks of people who work to track and report border enforcement vehicles, follow and disrupt agents in their operations, and warn vulnerable people to their approach so they might avoid capture. This tactic becomes more effective the more people in the community are prepared to be involved on spontaneous notice. One scream or one whistle quickly becomes 5, then 10, then 30 within moments. People fly from their houses and into the snow half-dressed to heckle agents, kick their cars, pelt them with snowballs, block their path. Counter-surveillance is deployed by ICE watchers to uncover the identities of individual agents and make them more vulnerable to reprisals. Where border enforcement agents live, eat, sleep, ICE watchers endeavor to disrupt, to hound them right out of their uniforms, to chase them all the way back home, and, even there, to never allow them a moment's rest from screaming. Not to be missed are the various attacks on and disruption to border enforcement infrastructure. Here are efforts to block their vehicles from returning to their buildings. There, an attempt to harass an ICE contractor away from providing a plane, a bus, a fence, a room, a meal. Another agitates against local police involvement in the 287G program. There's someone setting fire to a warehouse that's under consideration as a site for a future concentration camp, but shh, if anyone asks, we didn't see it happen. Concurrent and of equal importance to ICE Watch tactics, though necessarily less visible, are the strategies that provide care to border enforcement's targets outside of state and capitalistic structures that increase people's vulnerability to policing operations. People who are trapped in hiding from an ethnic cleansing campaign need food, clothing, housing, protection from eviction, medical care, schooling, and more. many networks with a focus on caring labor have to practice extreme caution. Any errors with informational security could inadvertently lead agents to the very people these networks exist to protect. People in Minneapolis involved in grocery runs to those in hiding share a practice of writing their addresses down on pieces of paper they can quickly eat if stopped by agents. To get children to and from school, there are adults stationed on every corner, ready to shout the warning and move with rapidity to get them to cover in safety. School bus drivers deny agents access to their vehicles. Teachers ready to defend their classrooms from raids. With border enforcement stalking hospital and clinic parking lots, alternative forms of medical care have been mobilized and strengthened. Participating healthcare laborers are finding themselves engaged in a more holistic service than the medical industrial complex ever allows. Doing home visits, bringing groceries along with medicine, their medical vans doubling as buses to take children safely to their classes. When oppression has a lineage that can be traced and learned from, so too does resistance. There has never been, nor will there ever be, an oppressive force without challenge, even as certain forms of resistance have gone undervalued or unrecognized. An authoritarian must always be engaged in counterinsurgency, their target always in some way insurgent, that is, always resisting being rendered into an object marked for extraction and consumption. Because of this, historic tactics of disruption and resistance are there to nourish the insurgence of the present and to be adapted to our conditions. ICE Watchers did not invent the strategies they are mobilizing to defend against this campaign of ethnic cleansing, nor are current ICE Watch tactics their most militant expression. Most, if not all, of the tactics leveraged against border enforcement have precedent in centuries of agitating against police enforcement, incarceration, slavery, and the anti-blackness that conditions them. Strategies of counter-surveillance deployed to such effect today, physical witnessing, digital witnessing, documenting abuses, broadcasting them strategically to mobilize others against regime, have black women as their most likely inventors and certainly their most dedicated practitioners. Quote, from Ida B. Wells' systematic documentation of white mob lynchings in the 1800s to Darnella Frazier's 2020 recording of George Floyd's murder, which sparked international protests against police violence, black women have occupied the role of witness for others experiencing state violence. From the first acts of resistance to enslavement to black community defense under the boot of Jim Crow, to the Black Panthers policing the police, to the uprisings in Minneapolis in 2020 in response to the murder of George Floyd, it is evident that a great debt is owed to the influence of centuries of black liberation movements. Every such movement has had to engage in a conflict of extreme asymmetry, has had to do so while being utterly denied the power and privileges of white citizenship, has by vital necessity developed various and nuanced strategies to resist state violence, and has creatively adapted previous ones to their own context. ICE Watch could not exist in its current form without Cop Watch. With the increased attention and participation ICE Watching is receiving, it is especially vital to connect the movement against border enforcement to the struggle against police power and resist every attempt made to distance the two. In part because, as previously established, there is no meaningful distance between border agent and police officer to justify such a distinction. Police have always acted as border enforcement agents, and that aspect of their role is becoming more explicit. Further, looking to the lineage of cop watching gives context to the strategies being deployed and situates them appropriately in relationship to the wider struggle against white supremacy. The tactics of physical witnessing and mobilizing others for community protection against white supremacy predates any project that developed these tactics in formal organization. When there is a threat, it is an old and steady logic to set up a watch. Formal organization for this purpose, however, is still many decades old and has its precedent in the militant self-defense of black people. The Deacons for Defense began their first chapter in 1964 to protect local black people and civil rights organizers in the South from attacks from the police and the KKK. They acted as an armed presence to dissuade racist violence and defend against it when necessary, stood guard at homes of especially vulnerable people, acted as secure transport for endangered organizers, and served as an organizational model for the founding of the Black Panther Party in 1966. The Panthers showed up to police encounters with law books as well as arms, while other parts of their programs focused on providing food, medical care, and education to black communities. In late 1960s Minneapolis, the American Indian Movement, Black Power, and Chicanx liberation groups organized their own patrols, the Black Patrol, the AIM Patrol, and the Brown Berets, respectively, to challenge police and white vigilante violence against their communities. While there are undeniably women who are also mothers on the front of the struggle against regime, it is unsettling how all adult women active in resistance are often assumed to be moms without direct cause. It often seems as though a woman might only be celebrated as a valid participant in a struggle if her success in the institution of the family can be imagined, if they can hear her screams as an echo of a husband or perhaps a son. It tells an old story. It tells much the same story federal agents and cops narrate when they crack a woman's ribs, when they take out her eye, when they kidnap her loved ones, her liberty, her life. That a woman's place under patriarchy is in confinement, and her life is defined by roles. Which is why more can and must be said about women, specifically. Unmatched are women's voices and tactics, and they are to be found on every front. In nearly every viral video of resistance to border enforcement, a woman's voice pitches above all others to scream in anger, in rage, in grief. Women are racing behind agents in their cars, and when those cars are wrecked, they climb into another woman's car to act as navigator. Women are mobilizing complex social networks they have been part of for decades, redesigning them utterly for the sole purpose of community defense and fighting regime. Women are creating entirely new networks in one instance, dissolving their formation in the next, and suddenly reappearing on a different line of attack. Women know that these tactics are incomplete without care, without food, housing, and medical care provided by mutual aid. Women know this not because of some inherent instinct towards caregiving, but because in a world dominated by men, knowing these things is the only way to survive on the gendered margins. Women know how to ask the important questions that men, including those amongst their comrades, have generally neglected to consider all of their lives. How do you feed people under attack? How do you get children to school, especially when doing so risks violent harassment? How do you make sure someone in hiding is getting necessary medical attention? How might one avoid or be protected from a determined stalker, especially when that stalker is on friendly terms with the local cops? What kind of information or patterns of behavior seem benign but ultimately risk the safety of someone vulnerable? How do you resist under a system of extreme surveillance, under the constant threat of debilitating violence, and within an entrenched asymmetry in power? Few women are better positioned to challenge regime narrative than the women of color who have survived the extremes of its deprivations and violence. Marimar Martinez followed Border Patrol in her car, horn blaring, screaming, "La Migra!" and successfully warning a migrant landscaping crew of danger's approach for 20 minutes before Agent Charles Exum rammed her car and shot her 5 times. In the aftermath of the shooting, regime lied and claimed that Martinez had rammed the agent's car, declared her a domestic terrorist, and charged her with assaulting the officers. Describing her choice to follow the Border Patrol vehicle when it crossed her path, Martinez said, quote, "You just grow tired of living in fear, and, you know, I saw my opportunity." Seeing and taking opportunities to agitate against regime is what she has continued to do since she survived attempted murder. Quote, "Agent Charles Exum, my attempted executioner was Charles Exum. I think it is important now that the truth of this case is exposed that people know his name, Charles Exum." She is a survivor who knows the importance of naming names, of counter-surveillance, of exposure, and of remembering the dead. Quote, "Renee Good, Alex Preddy, Silverio Villegas Gonzalez should all be here today." Emphasis on historical continuity, and pattern in particular, is center in Alaya Rahman's testimony. Quote, "Not all autistic brains do this, but mine fixates on sounds, numbers, and patterns. In that moment, the pattern felt very strong to me, and I thought of Genoa Donald, an autistic black man killed by police during a traffic stop in 2021. I remembered Mr. Silvero Villegas Gonzalez, who was killed by ICE in his vehicle last year. When I hit the ground and people leaned on my back, I felt the pattern and thought of Mr. George Floyd, who was killed 4 blocks away." Rahman, like Martinez, reflects a sense that survivorship comes with a special responsibility. Or, perhaps more accurately, surviving extreme violence gives one special knowledge, perhaps most poignantly, of those who haven't survived, that compels many survivors to hone their own voice and project it, to wage insurrection on the public record, to let no one forget that violence is taken to its furthest extremes behind closed doors, especially behind the doors of the prison and the concentration camp. A prominent survivor of the earliest escalations of border enforcement under the Trump administration, Rumeyesa Öztürk, reflects the same priorities in Even God Cannot Hear Us Here, What I Witnessed Inside an ICE Women's Prison. In this piece, published 2 months after her 45-day incarceration in the South Louisiana ICE Processing Center, Öztürk prioritizes the over 900 women incarcerated there whose cases are not granted the same resources of her high-profile one. She details not only the horrific, torturous conditions in the concentration camp, but also, emphatically, the love and acts of resistance to be found among incarcerated migrant women. Quote, I found myself immersed daily in the love, beauty, resilience, and compassion of these women. We each found ourselves trapped in our own individual nightmares, but we found comfort and relief in one another, and we shared the burden and pain by listening to each other. No analysis of women's resistance can be complete without accounting for the everyday revolts waged by incarcerated women. It is on this terrain, where power asymmetry is most extreme, that the essentials for insurrectionary action are most evident. Where neglect unto illness or death is policy, care is resistance. Incarcerated women share sparse essentials with each other, provide medical care, tell stories, analyze politics together. They adorn each other in lovingly crafted jewelry, even though guards are sure to steal and trash them, and do it again the next day. Even when the women appear, they're most apathetic and disengaged. Quote, I remember seeing women cocooned in blankets, resembling lifeless figures as they finally managed to catch some rest in the late afternoon. Young, beautiful women seeking refuge in sleep just to cope with their harsh realities, dreaming of freedom, loved ones, and moments of safety. They are resisting with ferocity. In an environment of such extreme deprivation, even cocooning oneself in a blanket for the afternoon is a radical assertion of autonomy. Getting sleep when it is undermined intentionally, obscuring surveillance, abstaining from the routinization of incarceration. Insurrection is encoded in the incarcerated woman's every unsanctioned gesture. Women's solidarity with each other has long shaped the history of resistance against border enforcement. Look back to 17-year-old Carmelita Torres and the women with her who launched the bath riots of 1917. Against the forced stripping and dangerous gas baths required of Mexicans crossing the border into the United States. Torres had heard warnings through women's whisper networks of routinized sexual violation, of agents taking photos of naked women and posting them at local bars, and the dangers of the chemicals used. When agents stopped the trolley car Torres and other women were taking to work and demanded they submit to disinfection, Torres refused and urged the 30 other women of her car to do the same. They hurled insults at border agents and laid their bodies on the trolley tracks. The number of participants surged to over 100 within the hour, and attempts at suppression were met by women's joyful derision. A report from the El Paso Times described the scene, quote, Carranza cavalrymen were unable during the morning to make any headway against the crowd, although they drew their sabers threateningly. Women laughingly caught their bridles and turned their horses aside, holding the soldiers' sabers and whips. By the afternoon, the women's forces had expanded to several thousand. They seized the trolleys, they shut down the border, they pelted racists with stones. They broke apart cars and used them to block the Santa Fe Street Bridge. Quote, as soon as an automobile would cross the line, the girls would absolutely cover it. The scene reminded one of bees swarming. The hands of the feminine mob would claw and tear at the tops of the cars. The glass rear windows of the autos were torn out, the tops torn to pieces, and parts of the fittings, such as lamps and horns, were torn away. Carmelita Torres, a teenager at the time of her historical refusal, and the Bath Rebellion demonstrate the impossibility of separating women's rebellions and children's revolts. It is difficult indeed to find a woman's revolt free of children's influence, and it is just as rare to see a children's revolt without the support of women. However, focus and celebration of children's resistance in particular is paramount, and we are far from wanting in examples today. Look to the Dilley Children's Revolt that was launched from the inside of the South Texas Family Residential Center, the United States' largest concentration camp for children and their family members, predominantly women, as men are in most cases separated from their families entirely. News of the revolt was carried out of the prison on the power of children's screams. This is the same concentration camp where Liam Conejo Ramos and his father were sent after they were kidnapped, and where thousands of other children have been incarcerated since it first opened in December of 2014. In solidarity with Liam, on January 24th of 2026, dozens of children initiated a protest from within the concentration camp. They gathered together in the yard of the prison and screamed. They screamed, "Let us go!" They screamed, "Libertad!" They screamed without words, with fear, with rage, and, at their center, with a determination to disrupt. It was their screams that alerted someone with access to the outside world to the protest. Immigration attorney Eric Lee was rushed out of the camp due to what guards referred to only as an incident. The incident became unambiguous as soon as Lee stepped into the open air, into the overwhelming sound of children wailing. Outside of the camps, too, children are active against regime and border enforcement. Teenagers, many freshly licensed, are following ICE agents in their cars and participating in every aspect of ICE watch that adult activists are. They're organizing massive strikes on their schools. They're hounding cops and border enforcement agents on their skateboards. Their hands are the first to start erecting barricades. They are not the passive recipients of charity, but are at the forefront of countless projects for mutual aid. Migrant children with citizenship status are, as they have had to long before the current regime, strategically engaging with systems on behalf of undocumented family members to shield them from additional vulnerability. They're acting as interpreters. They're using themselves as distractions to lure border agents away from their loved ones. When captured, they engage in other types of refusal. They withhold their cooperation and undermine attempts to reduce them to pawns to be used against others. They're thrashing against their bonds. They're screaming. They're crying. They're making a scene. This is not an innate instinct to let loose, but an intentional tactic leveraged in response to an asymmetry of power. It is a strategy that has served children well in revolt for centuries. And there children are, resisting ferociously back through time. There, too, their screams are acts of insurrection, a call to arms, a means of exposing state violence. In a 1953 memo from Border Patrol Inspector David Snow, he complained of women and children using the, quote, professional method of making a scene to avoid capture or free themselves from it. As Kelly Little Hernandez details in her history on U.S. Border Patrol, quote, upon apprehension, Snow explained, children would immediately begin to cringe and cry. In the public places where apprehension quite often occurred, the shrieking and struggling of children who had been grabbed by Border Patrol officers often forced the embarrassed officers to let the children free. The public resistance of rebellious women and children turned U.S. Border Patrol officers enforcing federal law into men embarrassed by their mandate and created what Snow described as a spectacle that was becoming an untenable situation for the U.S. Border Patrol. It is the same strategy, combined with counter-surveillance, that was leveraged by the three daughters of Perla Morales Luna as CBP agents dragged their mother into a van in March of 2018. One of the girls recorded while they all screamed in distress, cried, called for their mom, begged the agents not to take her. It was their willingness to make a scene, to make state violence apparent, that brought others nearby to the mother's defense as she was taken, and even more to her aid when their video was shared widely. Their mother's later release can almost entirely be credited to her daughter's fierce resistance on her behalf. Youth are not only spontaneous insurrectionaries, but dedicated organizers with a special talent for striking. The frequency and scope of school walkouts in only the first few months of 2026 are incredible, but not unprecedented, especially as a tool of resistance to white supremacy and border enforcement. For a full week in March of 1968, in what would become known as the East Los Angeles Blowouts, over 22,000 Chicanx students walked out of their classrooms to protest racist disparities in their education. There, we find another example of the inseparability of children's and women's resistance. When Roosevelt High School locked their fences to prevent students from leaving, Vicky Castro used a chain and her old Mazda to pull the fence gates down and free them. In 2006, again in LA, Chicanx students organized another walkout of over 40,000 participants to protest a bill that would have made attaining legal residency more difficult, criminalized migrants and anyone who aided them, and likely result in mass deportations. The influence of this lineage can be seen in the militant student strikes that have taken the streets of LA repeatedly since the beginning of the second Trump administration. Quote, unencumbered by formal speeches and megaphone-driven chants, The participants have instead spent their time setting off fireworks and smoke bombs, doing burnouts at intersections, and chanting Curero at the cops. Anger, frustration, excitement, and joy have mingled in the streets as cumbias and corridos blast from car stereos and live bands, and the smell of burning rubber fills the air. Here is another era of children's revolts. Like throughout recorded time, children are the unrecognized militants of the front, in many cases taking insurrectionary initiative well ahead of their adult comrades. They are among border enforcement's prime targets and their greatest enemies. Youth are defecting from the institutions designed to contain and indoctrinate them, and they are using this flight to agitate on a wider scale. They're pouring out of high schools, middle schools, elementary schools, kindergartens, and into the public spaces that have been forbidden to them. They are remaking the commons by the force and audacity of their presence. Paint drips from their fingertips and splatters with their every gesture. Window glass disintegrates in their passing, like the buildings became suddenly ravenous for air. Anarchism blooms in the shade of their heels. It's trying to catch a ride on the gum stuck to the bottom of their shoes. When man tries his violence on them, children swarm him like ants in a fury. There's one boy with his arms tightly latched, a vice around the man's fragile neck. Don't you hear the vertebrae cracking? There's two kids, no, five now, clawing at his face, pulling out his teeth, plunging anxiously bitten nails into the jelly of his eyes. Look, there, it's the girl the man struck first. Now she's tearing the paper of his lungs between her hands like a contract voided. What the patriarch fears. Border enforcement of the past developed strategies of counterinsurgency in response to the effective resistance of their targets. The policy of prevention through deterrence has been priority over the decades because border violence made visible, public, and disturbing diminishes public image and logistical efficiency in a way that thousands dying quietly in the most hostile stretches of the borderlands does not. This regime's changes in prioritization and border policy are profoundly frightening, and the devastation already caused is incalculable. But in its escalations, too, are great weaknesses that are being exploited by audacious insurrectionaries even as this is being written. Regime's preferred tactics require a ground presence it must pull from many other areas and agencies to provide. Their threats are endless and extravagant, but not every threat is acted upon, nor is it ever performed with the efficacy and strength their rhetoric suggests. They have been pushed back from territory they claimed to have clenched in their fists for all of time. In a regime of showmen, of reality TV stars and podcasters, it remains important to not let their performance lead us, and to instead use our own analysis to understand the terrain of conflict. In that terrain, women and children of color are vigorously targeted and to be found on the front of the most militant acts of resistance. The way regime targets them specifically demonstrates how intertwined the political projects of white supremacy and patriarchy are in the United States, how instrumental they are to the radicalizing fascist regime, and how vital it is that their every expression be attacked. The way women and children insurrect against oppression, when every battle is marked by an extreme and deadly asymmetry, it is not merely something to be intentionally learned from, but a fact that has already shaped the nature and scope of resistance itself since the first authoritarianisms took material form. Behind every successful ice watcher tactic is a lineage of racialized women and children's insurrectionary praxis. There is no front in the struggle against regime they cannot be found, though too rarely are they sought after, and more rarely still are they truly seen. Seen or not, there they are. Their voices can be heard pitching high, angry, fearful, and utterly determined at every action against border enforcement and ethnic cleansing. Survivors of state violence emerge and sing much the same song, though perhaps in a different key. The women and children still locked away in concentration camps sing it too. Some days they may only whisper the tune, its melody only hinted on a gasping breath, a secret passed slyly between trembling hands. Other days, they, too, are screaming it. It is the kind of insurrection that makes even prison walls, if only for an afternoon, a kind of permeable. The Trump administration has abandoned many effective strategies of counterinsurgency, declared them boring and weak, and fired everyone who might say otherwise. Rather than carefully framing the insurgent as inherently separate from the civilian, they declare entire city populations insurrectionaries that must be dealt with in force. They encourage their agents to indiscriminate deadly violence by offering them public support and private promotions like the one offered to Agent Charles Exum only hours after he shot Marimar Martinez. They act as if there is little substantive difference between the public, insurrectionaries, and the people they're targeting for ethnic cleansing. Because of this, the costs, economic, logistical, and to agent morale, of their operations will only increase. By depriving citizens of liberal, non-confrontational means of protesting, while also invading the public spaces many of them expect safety and stability in, schools, churches, hospitals, the fascist regime forces more people into postures of direct anti-state action, as well as into closer proximity to more radical movements. All things that decades of U.S. military counterinsurgency theory warns to avoid at all costs. It makes for a shockingly violent and theatric oppressive force, but not for regime stability. Regime teeters and wobbles under its own awkward weight, top-heavy, with a core they continue to foolishly hollow out as effeminate waste. It's put all of its power into arms, arms so bulky they cannot touch their own shoulders, cannot even adjust the tin crown upon the withering head. Women and children know what to do when the patriarch is off balance. Push. The ways to push are many, most covert, all insurgent. Remove the air from his tires or the oxygen from his blood. Tangle his shoelaces, sabotage his meals, set fire to his bed. Look out for him and scream when he approaches. Spit in his face, dig your teeth into his ankles. Slam the door on his fingers and barricade against his movements. When he comes for the children, the women bait his attention. When he comes for the women, the children do the same. When he comes for anyone, he comes into a decentralized mass of rage, into a chaos of directionless wailing that makes his ears bleed and his stomach turn traitor. He came here to professionalize his hatred of other in blood sport, and instead he finds evidence of a fact he has always feared, though he's been sheltered from it all his life. Women and children hate him profoundly, have always hated him, and are always waiting for the right opportunity to undo him. Here he comes into direct contact with the truth of his power. It is the only thing protecting him. And everywhere around him, the promised strength of its structures is giving way. His greatest terrors are manifest. One day, all the power he will have left will be the power of his gun. And what does it mean for him that women and children don't run from those the way they used to? The implications make him tremble in his Kevlar. His great arms thrash about, and his vast fists clench, but again and again they close on nothing.